Mr. Cameron, Reel 11. You just arrived and rejoined A Company, 16th Battalion DLI, in the Athens area. Where exactly were the battalion when you joined them?
They were, all of them were in the Athens area. They tell me they were flown across, they'd been pulled out of the line anyway. I don't know whereabouts, but they'd flown across and landed at Kalamaki Airdrome outside of Athens. And apparently they had to fight their way from the airdrome with the ELAS being on the outskirts of the airdrome. And then they had moved down onto the outskirts of Athens on the waterfront. That's where they were when I joined them. But most of the trouble then, by the time I got there, was quiet. They'd all gone quiet. But they had a hectic time whilst I had been missing. So they finally got killed. They'd had to work up and down from, was it Palawan? I think it was Palawan they called the place, which is the port part of Athens, along what they called a mile, backward and forward from the Athens city to Palawan. They had the whole of that. That was their territory, and they had to fight their way through that lot. And I know there was one pal of mine who's a section commander. He had got winkled out with the ELAS. They pinched the whole platoon, surrounded them, pinched them out of this house, and they carted them away up in the hills, pinched the boots off them, and they had them prisoner for quite a while. And then when they were finally released, they sent them on a 1-3 home. They were just part of the thing. But when it quietened down and such, the battalion was organising some kitchens and things for the feed of population. So they did a decent job, but like I say, when I got there, it was all quiet and down.
And where exactly were they?
On Fallaron, on the waterfront, the port.
And what were you actually doing?
It was very little, very few duties, more of a holiday period. They had Christmas. They'd had the fight right through the Christmas period. So we had Christmas in about February and March. So I was lucky. I had two Christmases that year. One in Italy, and then when we got back to the town, I had another one. Christmas dinner, which they celebrated. It was only back in the February, beginning of March.
Now, then they went to, you had all taken on a boat to Patras.
My company were detached, A Company. We sailed on a boat out of Fallaron, and we went round the Greek islands, the Peloponnese, and landed at Patras. And there was a concentration of ELAS there. It was a much smaller place and wilder than the Athens area of Greece. And whether it was occupation or what, I don't know. It was the same thing. They didn't bother telling us. You know, we just went there. We occupied a couple of huts. We were there in a little bit of a footed camp. And we had no duties or anything. Come around there was a little airfield. There was never any trouble, but we were there.
Did you have any sympathy for the ELAS cause? Or
it's hard to say. We just didn't understand why we had to fight them, more or less. We didn't know what they were fighting for and who they were fighting. We just knew that they were fighting us. But we didn't know who they were unless you could see them. Well, you could see them when we got to Petras. We went out of Petras to this little airfield, a place called Aeon. And there was a little village there, and I remember we went down into one of the little places to have a drink. And we were surrounded with blokes with bloody whiskers and all carrying rifles and leather bandoliers across the chest and all. And we were sitting drinking more or less with them, you know what I mean? And they were the enemy that apparently were the ELAS. would there have been a truce or something at the time? We mixed with them sailors, we mixed with any of the civilians. And that was the end. But we weren't there very long. Not at all. Like I say, we never had any trouble. They pulled us back out of there and we went back to Athens. But we came back by road. And we came back in trucks by road and from place to place. And there's lots of little bridges and they were all blown in the middle. Well, I'd done the sabotage, weren't very good because he'd blown the bridges in the middle and of course he tipped into the riverbed and he could go down one side, up the other side. So we just drove all the way through. Every village was blown up, but it was blown so that the middle was down in the riverbed and he could just drive over it. So it didn't have stopped us at all. One or two places we had a winch or something, you know. He was short. We went back to Athens. We were there quite a while. And that's how I got the tape back there. That's when I got to be a Lance Corporal again because they had a NCO's training car. It was back at time when I happened and they were getting the battalion back into shape. Sent me on this car there and
now you didn't mind now. Did you feel you'd sort of paid your dues as a private?
I thought, yes. I think I could handle this now. I was, to my mind, well, I'd say, I had as much experience as quite a lot of them who were there then. And they were getting to know me. And I had NCO experience behind me, you know. And I could... It's hard to say just... When you've had senior NCO experience and you have most of a bunch who haven't had it, you can be a leader of sort. They used to look to you for give them the lie as to which way to handle the situation. So
even before you became a Lance Corporal.
Yeah. And they went off on this car, well, it was a Doddle. Because it was Captain Footer who was taking the car.
And what were they teaching you, or what were they meant to be teaching?
Basic NCO stuff, section leaders and so on, you know, and your duties as a section leader and such like, and how to read NCO, sort of. Well, I know one particular thing we were... It was all done in the open, the weather was good, and we were having a thing where, I think it was Captain Footer himself, or it might have been his lieutenant, what was helping him out. But anyway, he called one of us out and said, "Oh, give him a lecture on the bench one or something, a 10-minute talk on the bench one." So he used to get up. And it's, without experience, it's not easy to do, to talk to a bunch of your mates. And it came to my turn, like, and of course they were all spread out all over the place, lying around smoking, you know, and I said, "Cameron, come out here. Give him 10 minutes on the 36th grenade." So I get out there. Of course, he had a table and everything, and a chair, and they were sitting like that. I get out there. And, "Right, call in." Of course, they all looked, you know. He said, "Come on, all of you move in. I want to be able to talk to you." So there'll be three or four talk before me, you see. But of course, they looked and another chairman said, "Come on, shift. Get in here where I can see you." And I bunched them all together in front of the table, took my watch off and put it on the table and put myself and see the timing, you know. And of course, the officer's watching this all the time. So I gave him a 10-minute patter, which was no bother to me with the 36th grenade. He was right, "You can carry on smoking now." I said, "All right, yeah, carry on." I never had no more trouble with that card. Just straight away, when the card was finished, about 2 days later, it was recommended promotion to Lance Corporal. And I think it was when the sergeant said, oh, he says, they were saying, he says, obvious NCOA experience, you know. So I was made up straight away to Lance Corporal.
Anything else before you left Greece? Because you went on leave from Greece, didn't you?
Yes, leave. That's when the leave started. L-I-A-P, leave. Leave in addition to Python. That was a lot of blokes had been out overseas 3, 4, 5 years then, you know. And the war hadn't finished, but it had quietened down in the Mediterranean theatre, the more the fighting was in Europe then after D-Day. And they started this leave thing. The Python was, I think, were mainly regular soldiers who they'd done their time overseas and they were sent home to England. Leave in addition to Python, that was leave. That was, you got a month home leave, and then went back to your unit. And then they had another thing, Lila, leave in lieu of Python. Leave in lieu of Python, that was, you got your month's leave, and then went back to your unit, but didn't get posted home. And that was a scheme started up for blokes who had been overseas quite a while and never had a home leave. Well, that was done by numbers. You had those who were number 20 was about the first, I think. I would think it worked on how many months you'd been overseas or something. I was number 26, and the 25s went off, and we were still hanging around Athens area at that time, just more or less exercises, bits of training, going on bits of field firing and such. Then my time came up to come home, and it was getting into April. It was in April, in fact, because they sent me off, I went to a transit camp, out of Athens, got on a boat there, went across to Italy, to Naples, went in a transit camp at Naples. I don't know how long that took, but it took a while. We hung around there for 5 or 6 days, but we got on a trooper and we were sailing home. Now, I was sailing up the Atlantic when the war finished. That was beginning of May, somewhere beginning of May. I know it took me a month to travel from the battalion to home. And like I say, the war finished while we were travelling up the Atlantic.
How did you feel? How did you feel about that?
I was really pleased about it. More so, we were on our way home as well, you see. And we landed at Glasgow. Corrick, Governor Clyde, and we went into a camp there for overnight, and they fitted us out with train passes and leave certificates and paid us money and such like, and then we got all dispersed in the morning, but we had all the kit with us, a lucky lot, a little rifle, 100 rounds of ammunition. Now, I'm not sure about the ammunition, but certainly we had everything. Rifle, greatcoat, field service marching order, kit bag, the whole lot of gear, you know. And I'm only 5'4". But before we set off to get home, we had the evening in Gurk, and there was a fish and chip shop about 100 yards outside the camp. Everybody's off as soon as being paid and we were free from the camp. Everybody's off there. And outside that fish and chip shop, there was a queue 300 yards at least long, queuing up for fish and chips. It was a birthday time. It was a sight worth seeing that. there, and everybody stood and waited. But there was no dust to do. We just get there. I suppose some did go and start boozing up somewhere, but we're content just to wait there. They must have done a hell of a trade that night in a fish and chip shop. They were 300 yards long, all blokes off the ship. You know, I've fish and chips for years, you know what I mean, and that was the feed there.
Was it as good as you thought it was going to be?
Yes, I enjoyed it. And then we got on next morning, got on a train and sat down home for Tyneside. And it was a Sunday morning when I got home, strangely enough, and I got into Newcastle. With all that really gear, got off the train, and they had to get a bus out of Newcastle to where I lived, about 8 miles. And it was Sunday morning. When I got off the bus, it was just about 10 minutes to 12 Sunday morning, and they were all standing outside the motor, all the local blokes, and they were there in the series, waiting for the boat to open. Hopped off that bus, got me gear on, big pack. Kid bag on my shoulder, rifle on the other one, and I way down, and I could see all the heads looking, you know. And it was 500 or 600 yards from that bush stop down the hill into my street where I lived. So I hopped down there, and I don't know, I'd written to say I was on the way home, but that was a month ago, and I haven't written since. And that one. I got to my street end, walked round the corner, and I'll never forget this. My mother was standing at the backyard door with the broom, been sweeping the step the way that they always do, you know. She come dashing over and up the street, oh my lad, my lad. She had tears in my bloody eyes, I don't think about that. Oh, take the death, I would do. Thinking of it in later years, you know. It was something like she was tickled at it. She didn't know when I was coming, except I was on the way home. And as a coincidence, she was on the bloody doorstep when I turned in the street. So that was there. I got home, got stripped off, and got settled in. She says, Billy's home. That was my older brother. I'd been a prisoner. I don't know if I told you before, but my brother, I'd been with the Northumberlands. Now, I came through Dunkirk, done a bit of time in England, went out to Holland in the Middle East before me with the Northumberlands, gone up the desert about a year in front of me all the way. And he had been captured at Knightsbridge in the desert. He'd gone to Italy in a prisoner of war camp in Italy, and of course when I got to the Middle East and I was inquiring about the 4th Northumberlands, nobody could tell me anything like apart from where they'd been in action and such. Nobody knew him. I heard from home he was in Italy. Eventually we got to Italy and I heard from home he was in Germany. He'd been transferred to Germany. When I got home, she said, Billy's home, they beat me home by 2 days.
How did you spend your leave?
Boozing.
Did you have the money?
Yeah, I don't know how come or how much or anything, but we were well off, whether it was credits or what. We both had it. I know Billy had a roll of notes, a fat roll of notes with elastic bags on them. We had been in a prisoner of war camp 3 or 4 years, but I don't know where that came from. But he was very quick. He was a lance corporal as well at the same time. He had been a regimental policeman. He's about a foot higher than me and twice as wide, you know. I was a reckoning in the family. And that was it. We spent the money boozing.
Did people understand what you'd been through at all? I mean, towards the end of the war, you'd had a rough time.
I don't know, there was a lot of us, there was blokes coming on leave all the time then, and of course, a lot of them were coming from France, where they were getting leave every 6 months. It wasn't the same as the odd ones like us, coming from Italy, or you were getting them from the Far East, from the Japanese job, and they, you know what I mean, they had had it rough out there. I don't know, it didn't affect us a great deal. And I know Billy was very bitter about the Italians, not the Germans, the Italians. And apparently there had been an Italian camp, prisoner of war camp, further up the river. And by that time, of course, the Italians were allies in Italy. The war had finished. And they were going to have a dance, one of the local dances. And somebody had told him that it gets full of Italians. And he went, well, he said, we're off up there, we're sorting them out, you know. He took a bit persuading not to go and cause any trouble with that, because I think he'd had it up amongst the Italians. He didn't like them at all, which I understood because I'd met them myself.
Now, you had to go back after your month,
yeah.
back to the 16th Battalion.
Back to the 16th Battalion.
Who were in, I think, Austria then.
In Austria when I got back.
How did you feel about that? I mean, did you mind?
Or no, I didn't mind that at all, especially... And I knew it wasn't going to be hard going. The war had finished. It was straightforward soldiering and that, so it wasn't a great deal to worry about.
You weren't agitating to get demobilised then?
No, not really, because I had no future apart from going in the really fit and getting. And as far as that goes, well, quite happy to soldier on. I was getting used to the infantry then as well. I had my Lance tape and I thought I can progress a bit further again.
So, what about the trip back?
Well, it was pretty similar to any of the trooping that we've done. We went from Liverpool again that time. I don't remember where we landed, but it was somewhere in Italy. And then it was transit camps away up and lorries away through up into Austria. And I joined them in a place called Bruckel Bridge. I think that's what it stands for, Bridge or something. But they were settled in there by that time. They had gone through northern Italy and up into occupied Austria. And they were settled in. A company was in Bruckel anyway, when I got back to them there. It was straightforward occupation.
Now, was it earlier in the occupation of Bruckel, they'd been involved in returning the Cossack brigade to the Russians? Was that still going on when you got there, or that all finished?
No, that had all settled down as far as I never heard a great deal about it, but I don't think they had a great deal to do with it either. It was mainly the Jocks who did that.
So what were you doing while you were at Bruckel?
There was odd guards on different places round about, but we eventually started patrolling out, looking, searching for Nazis and such like, or war criminals. Sort of thing.
Did you go on one of those patrols?
Where they go and do roadblocks and stop any vehicles and such and ask them for the Ausweis. We couldn't read any bloody German or anything, so it was a bit, seemed a bit silly. But wasn't it Bruckel we moved from there to, what do you call it?
Wilden?
Wilden, Steiermark. And it was Wilden where we started really doing roadblocks and patrols.
That'd be the back end of July.
It probably would be, yes. I got a good number there because there was a lot of them got on a horse patrol because the Jerrys had let the horses run all the while, you know. And they rounded all the horses up on the place where we were, the slosh at Vilden. They had the stables there. Well, you could get out and have a ride if you want a horse, if you wanted to. There wasn't many of them like to, they weren't used to horses. But anyway, they had a riding school as well where they taught the lads to ride some of them and made a horse patrol. Now, I didn't get on that, but I did get on the ski patrol. And they sent us right up in the hills. Oh, you know, in Austria. And it snow on the top. And we were stationed in one of those, what do you call the chalet things. There's no there except just bunk beds and working facilities and such like. We slept there and we ate in the guest house at the bottom of the hill. And we had a youngster, about 19 years old, a young Austrian, teaching us to ski. We got fitted out with all this gear, you know, the skin vest and the big pullover and waterproofs and like a parka with the hood and these fancy boots. We had a thing at the back of where your ski fitted, the spring of the ski, teaching us how to go uphill. That was really hard work. Coming down here, you had to fall over for the really stop at first. But we never got to be expert, but it was really good fun. You know, really good. You'd get up in the morning, you'd stick it. Everybody used to stick their skis outside the way you were supposed to do, standing on the edge where your points are on. You'd get up in the morning, get washed and shaved, dressed up, grab your skis, away down that hill. And like I say, the only way we could stop was to really fall over, so we used to roll up, take a skis out and off into the guest house, and we'd eat anything they put in front of us, with the fresh air, you know, and go. We would eat in the table, I think, and then for a fortnight, a few weeks, we did that. And this youngster, he was pretty amazing, on a pair of skis, he'd grown up with them, you know. The old land thing that was on the level, thought you know, it covered a lot of ground on skis. We had to go with the bloody snowshoes, and that was hard work. You know, you had to put those tennis rackets on your feet, you know, your knees had to come right up. Cool, did not look your legs. But anyway, we did that. We got back, and we never did a ski patrol.
No. You mentioned that you developed the roadblocks and the patrols around the, looking for Nazis. I mean,
on the outskirts of Berlin.
Did you ever find anybody?
No. I think it was more of a mockery about than anything.
Did you search houses?
No. No, it was just looking for people. We never had anything to do with the civilians. We got on well with the civilians, actually. And especially then, with the war being finished, and they got on well with us. They were anything they could get from us, naturally. You know what I mean? It was a black market place then. We'd put a bar of soap, you could get a meal and things like that. I know you weren't supposed to, like.
Did anybody take advantage? I mean, there's differences between selling odd bits and bobs and sort of raiding the storehouse to sell them to the black market.
Wasn't any big, not rife stuff. What you got yourself, the odd bars of chocolate, we got everything. We'd cart them off and go to one of the farmhouses and ask them about if they had any, what do you call it, must. It was more like apple cider or something, you know. It was a bit alcoholic, sort of, something like that. But there wasn't a great deal. There was a lot of fraternising with the Fräuleins then. That was a different kettle of fish to be in Italy and Egypt and those places. You could mix with the civilians, you know. And like I say, the Fräuleins were willing. We used to have dances and we made parties for the kids, the local kids, which was always a thing with the British Army, you know. The first way to get in with the locals was to look after the nippers.